Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. News Talk, WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5. Working hard for the money. Don't we all?
We do.
And the main man here in Maine, working hard for the money, please welcome Dana Connors. He is the president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, which by definition is working to promote and help sustain commerce in the state of Maine. Welcome, Dana.
Well, it's my pleasure. Nice to be back with you.
Have you ever had that theme music, you know, working hard for the money?
Boy, it gets you cranked up.
It really does.
That's good. Good stuff.
Well, we've had you here before, and, you know, obviously I am very much interested in Maine's economy, and we have many opportunities and many challenges, so I want to get to that. But if we can just spend a minute, I think your background is really interesting in terms of diversity of public service, and we were just talking about, you know, coming down from the county. So give a brief synopsis in terms of your background, and then we'll talk about what the Maine State Chamber of Commerce does, and then how that relates to many, if not most, communities have their own local Chamber of Commerce, and then where we go from there.
Great. Well, you could write my experience probably in the back of a napkin. I've had three jobs. I just stay at those jobs for a long time, but I will say I have had the best luck possible in those jobs because they've all been the type of opportunity for me that is very energizing, is exciting, and I have been extremely fortunate. I was city manager, started at the ripe age of, well, I just turned 24. My hair started to turn white, so I don't think they knew I was that young. But like a lot of us at that age, I didn't lack confidence. I just lacked a lot of knowledge. But
that
I
was
had
a Prescott,
great board.
Right?
Yeah, it was. It's a fantastic city.
How do they pick a 24-year-old? Many 24-year-olds I meet today, I wouldn't put in charge of a municipality kind of organization. How did you get that?
They may have thought that after a year or so as well. But I will say this. The program that I was in at the University of Maine had internships, and both the undergraduate and graduate degree, and the program was really, you define it as town and city government, but it was called public management. And though, and so you went to a city to intern during the summer. And as luck would have it, the city manager at the time in Prescott was the one that I interned under, both undergraduate and graduate, an absolutely wonderful person, but also a great mentor. I went there because my family, who were rich in, when it came to family and love and support for their kids, weren't wealthy when it came to financial. And summer was the time that I generated that money I needed to go back to college. So instead of going to a large city to the south where I had to pay a lot just to get through the summer, I, again, serendipitously went to Prescott and ended up being the best thing I could ever have done because when I got through working with on the graduate degree, the city council at the time and the manager said, hey, listen, would you be willing to come back and we will create a job assistant manager and you can use that to stay here and work, or you can use it as a foundation for seeking management jobs elsewhere. I was there very few months when John left to go to Concord, New Hampshire. He was a city manager, I should say.
Right.
And they knew me. They knew I, you know, that they'd had the experience for two summers. And as good fortune had it, they asked me if I'd take the job, and I said absolutely.
So some of your former classmates were probably interns in jobs, and you walked into a situation from hard work and from them knowing you to being city manager.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, the latter point, they knew me and they were very supportive. And I cannot say enough about the counselors that I worked with or the city. It was a city that was very, very supportive of me and forgave my mistakes. It was like a family for me. So when I had the opportunity to go then, when the governor called Governor Brennan at the time to ask me to become Commissioner of Transportation, I was very reluctant. I said no a couple of times, and the rest is history. I ended up going there. In the first year, I think when I came home to visit my wife and kids, I probably cried all the way back because I realized what I'd left behind. in Presque Isle. But after a year there, I found at the Department of Transportation, which I served for 11 years under two different governors, they too were like a family, and they were very supportive. And then I've been here at the state chamber for 22 years. So my resume is pretty short. I just stay a long time. Don't add all those up because you realize I'm 110 years
old.
I'm
doing the math right here.
No, don't. Please don't.
Graduate, you mean 65, then you
went
to Presque Isle.
Okay, any questions?
But before, before we talk about the Chamber of Commerce, what was and is the purview of the Commissioner of Transportation here in Maine? And is it having to do with like MDOT infrastructure? What are the elements when you were in that oversight? Because obviously you were doing something right with both Governor Brennan and then Angus King, when he became governor. I'm assuming he asked you to stay on, so you served under his administration, too?
Well, the governor you missed in between was McKernan.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and then for Angus, I was his transition director, which wasn't a paid position. It was an extreme honor, but it was to help him set up his new cabinet and to work through those first few months. My job as Commissioner of Transportation was to oversee an employee base of about 2,300 that had responsibilities for about 8,700 miles of roads. You had the three cargo port facilities. You had, at the time, we started during my time, the return of passenger rail, the Downeaster, but it wasn't in play. It was going through all the due diligence to get it here. But you had air, most of it being facilities. When it came to the port facilities in Penobscot Bay, we were responsible for both the ferry service, but also the infrastructure, the stations. Here in Portland, it was a part. We were responsible for the facility. They were responsible, Casco Bay Island Transit District, for the actual service. So you have planes, trains, automobiles, the element of public transportation, which for us at that time was really our bus service. So it was pretty inclusive. When you think of transportation, with the exception of the turnpike, it was all-inclusive. The turnpike was not a formal relationship. I sat on the authority as they do today, but they're a separate, distinct operation that oversees that 100 of miles that we know to be the turnpike.
Right. I think now is Peter Mills still overseeing that?
Yes, he is. Yeah.
Part of the underachieving Mills family. And I say that jokingly. I've got the utmost respect for his sister Janet Mills, Attorney General, and Dora Mills, who I believe is still at University of New England.
Yes,
she's done some great things, and she was the chief health officer for the state. And every time, and they've all been here, and every time I'm trying to get them together, and fascinating family.
You'd want more than an hour program.
I know. Yeah. Well, we have Dana Connors here. He's the president of Maine State Chamber of Commerce. So as we hurtle ahead to your third job since 1965. Was it 1994 that you became the president of the Maine State Chamber?
It was. It was late in 94, actually about the time that Angus King was elected governor, because I was selected to go to the chamber, but I ended up going with Angus for about 3 or 4 months, and then to the chamber. Yep.
So for the last 22 years, president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. So why don't we start with, everyone has an idea, or when you say Chamber of Commerce in a local community, you sort of have the idea of what the role is. But on the state level, explain a little bit what the Maine Chamber of Commerce is, the structure, how many people, what the mandate is, and then we'll talk about what's going on here in Maine.
Great. The Maine State Chamber of Commerce, think of it as the voice for Maine business. We place a high priority. In fact, we have three full-time lobbyists who focus on legislative issues, both pro and con, those that help grow the economy, those that stand in the way of growing the economy. We have three lobbyists who spend their time in the legislature focused on those issues. We also, in the last several years, have come to realize that as that is our primary focus, it's sometimes not enough. We have an incredibly good luck in the type of representation that we have in Washington. And we also recognize that a lot of issues that we deal with today, their genesis is Washington. So the combination of the two, we've established working relationships with the four of them, And we make an annual visit. We're constantly in contact with them about issues. They seek our input, and we obviously look to them for guidance. So a good part of it, and when you say the voice, and that's what we're recognized for, it is to be in the legislature representing business. We at the same time place a high premium being sure that we work with local and regional chambers. Their focus is more regional in nature and a lot of community type of focus. But we also realize they are the closest to their legislators. So we have a grassroots program that reaches out to them, that contacts our legislator on key issues. And frankly, I have believed from day one that our brand as a chamber is stronger when we're recognized as one, as a family. It doesn't mean we all do the same thing, but we all share the same purpose. And when the world sees us as a chamber family, we all prosper. We all do better. I mean, it's a fundamental lesson of life. It doesn't have to apply to us. It could apply to anything or everybody. It sounds a little bit like Grampy Dana talking, but I do sincerely believe that statement.
So how many member chambers do we have in Maine? We have about 480 municipalities, but how many
we have
towns and cities actually have chambers that you work with and there's direct linkage with?
The actual count is close to 60, but that's kind of misleading because a lot of them are volunteer organizations that come together for a purpose, a celebration, an activity to highlight what's going on in their community and in their village. Those that have actual organizational structure probably number more like 25 to 30, and they either have a staff or they have a office in which they have a paid employee. And we really in the last several years have really tried to build that relationship and be seen as one. And here I'm repeating myself, but
fascinating. We've got Dana Connors here. He's president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. Their website is mainchamber.org. Talk about statewide issues that you either weigh in on or you have lobbyists speaking for the chamber before the state legislature. One comes to mind, minimum wage.
Yeah.
It may be the most contentious or debated issue because there are strong arguments on both sides. It's something that impacts businesses profoundly, the cost of labor. But it also has a profound impact on the quality of life here in Maine. So it's a very personal issue. Has the state chamber taken a position? And how do you communicate and how do you advocate for that position here in the state?
Yep. To your first question, what do we advocate for? Frankly, we have 5,000 businesses that are members. And it really reflects a profile of Maine's business community. When you think of Maine as a small business state, that probably is backed up more convincingly by this statistic. 79% of our businesses in Maine employ fewer than 20 people. If that ain't small business, as they say, my hair's not white. So when you're thinking of business issues, today it's just about everything. It's hard not to define impacts with most every issue. Now, we obviously don't represent every issue, but that's why I have three lobbyists, because one focuses on tax and appropriation issues, one focuses on all human resource, economic type issues. The other one, believe it or not, does environment, energy, and education, and education is a primary source. So I'm not ducking your question because we deal with everything from workers' comp to tax policy to budgets, you name it, we're there. This fall, we face five questions, referendum questions, and a bond issue that have tremendous impact on the state. And we are involved in two of those in what I would describe as leadership roles. First of all, if you allow me the time, let me just tell you what each of them are.
These are statewide referendum?
Yep. The first one is the marijuana question that opens it up to recreational marijuana that tends to regulate it, tax it, and so forth. That issue is an issue for business insofar as, aside from the social valuation that you place on it, But on the business side is how it becomes similar to alcohol. How do you regulate it? What do you do to, as a business, to deal with that issue? It's not like alcohol, and yet the impact in the workplace is, it can be very severe. So there's a regulatory issue to that. The second question that we're taking a very strong leadership role on.
But did you, have you stated any of your position on marijuana referendum? Does the chamber have a pro or against?
We haven't taken a formal position on that issue yet, but we have a board meeting in September that I would anticipate further discussion and a probable position to be taken. But it won't be a leadership. It'll be one that we recognize that that is more than a social question. It is a business implication as well. And if it has a business implication, we try to be out front on it. The second question, we're taking a leadership role on because it's one that on the face of it sounds very appealing. Stand up for students. Who does not stand up and support students? We want education for us is an extremely high priority. The key to our economic success is preparing our young people for today's economy and tomorrow's promise. What does that have to do with education? Everything to do with education. You can't get there without knowing that you got to prepare our people, whether it's through certifications, whether it's through the highest education possible, whatever it may be, education is premium. So if I say that, why do I have reservations and opposition to the question? Because it doesn't do what it purports to do. Number one, it seeks to put us in the highest tax bracket to the highest rate in the country. When you tax our highest marginal rate, which is 7.15, when you say that family income or small businesses that are a pass-through, like an LLC or an S-Corp, are going to be paying 3% on that income over $200,000. There are 11,000 small businesses that fit that category that will be paying. Do you think that's going to help them in a competitive environment that we live in today? I would argue absolutely not. They're going to have to pay a 10.15% income tax on that income. And as a family, it's your combined household income. And that between 200,000, which is the benchmark, and 500,000, we are number one in the country. If you're over 500,000, that puts us in second place behind California. There is no way that that appeals to our economy or are trying to attract. Can you imagine trying to attract physicians, scientists, technicians to come to Maine, particularly a rural place, when you've got to pay 10.15? Yeah, you argue it's over 200,000, but those people make over 200,000. Education has a strong priority to us, like I said a moment ago. But herein lies the problem. The advertising, the promotional says that there should be no differentiation between where you live. Zip code shouldn't matter in terms of what you're provided for money and so forth for schools. That suggests everybody gets something from that money that's raised to that tax. That's not true. Their own website, they prepared the legislation. Their own website points out there's 85 school systems that don't get a penny. In addition to that, there's 35 that are parts of RSUs that don't get any. There's additional 36 that get less than 100,000. So you get 150 plus out of 230 units that get zip or very little. There's 31, however, of the wealthy communities that get 60% of the dollars. And besides that, you can only spend the money on salaries. You can't spend them on technology, on helping improve buildings. You can't do what a number of systems need to do. You have to put them in salaries. So while on the face of it, you say, oh, yeah, that's great. When you look behind the issue, it's very disturbing because it's a right problem, but the wrong solution. We need to do something to certainly foster education, but not the method that's been put forward. And I'm concerned because it could easily pass and we would regret it, in my opinion.
Okay, we have Danny Connors here, president of Maine State Chamber of Commerce. We are getting around to talking about minimum wage.
We are.
And in the fourth hour of the show, we will be tackling minimum wage. I know.
I told you. You shouldn't have asked me on the show.
No, I love having you on the show. You are you represent an important constituency relative to businesses and chamber. Minimum wage, what is your thinking, and what will the chamber officially take as a position?
This has a long history in the previous legislative session, and let me be very, very clear. To increase the minimum wage from $7.50 is the right thing to do. The question is, how far do you go, and to what degree can businesses absorb that and still survive? Increase it. We proposed in this last legislative session, when I say we were a coalition of others. I mean, there was the innkeepers, there were restaurant association, the retail association, ourselves, grocers. There were a number of them that came together that said, yep, the time is right to increase it. But $12 by 2020 is a little bit too far. But more importantly, perhaps than that, or more significant than that, is the fact that every year after 2020, every single year, there will be a cost of living adjustment. And the tip credit is a major issue for our restaurants. Maine is blessed. Portland has received incredible distinction as a foodie town. And if you have any question about the value of that type of image, walk down Commercial Street or any part of Portland these days, and you'll find it is an amazing challenge because people are coming there for all the reasons we know. Tip credit. They want to change that to make it like a minimum wage that goes up. Now, it won't achieve that same level by 2020. It'll take 2024. Whereas today, the tip credit, as you probably already aware, is half of the minimum wage, $3.75. But you're guaranteed at least the minimum wage because the restaurant is responsible for making up the difference if you don't get it in tips.
Right.
Truth is, most do and do very well.
So what is the referendum question on minimum wage? I don't have it in front of me, but in general,
three parts.
So there's three parts that will be on the ballot on November 8th.
Yep. And the three parts are that we will put in place. It starts actually in 2017. It goes from $7.50 to $9 and incrementally increases until 2020 when it reaches $12, part one. Part two is every year thereafter, there will be a cost of living adjustment. That doesn't mean goes down.
So we don't get in the same place we've gotten where one argument is over the last 20 or 30 years. We've fallen so far behind on minimum wage that now we're faced with kind of a critical state where there has to be a big jump. And the idea of cost of living, there's a number of indexes, government indexes, where every year Social Security is pegged to it. So if the cost of goods and services for a person goes up 1.2% or 0.4%, then the minimum wage should stay on pace. So in effect, you're neutral buoyancy and you don't fall behind.
Yeah, I mean, that's
one argument.
That is a very good argument. However, the other part is when I or our, when I say I, the organization that I represent on behalf of businesses will tell you when they're one of their biggest challenges and greatest obstacles is the lack of predictability, whether it's in regulations, whether it's in laws, so that if you're putting a business plan together and you're putting your performance together based upon, let's say, $12 an hour, and you've had to make some adjustments to accommodate that. And it is 2020. And again, I go back. We're not arguing that there shouldn't be an increase. Our biggest concern has to do with maybe the $12 is a bit high, but more problematic is the annual adjustment because, you know, what's it going to be next year? And what's it going to be the year after? And you've got an awful lot of small businesses, entrepreneurial, that are living on the skin of their teeth, so to speak. And this matters. It makes a difference. You add to that the tip credit that turns the restaurant industry kind of upside down is a major concern. So when you take minimum wage, you take question two, which is an educational one, which puts in place a high tax. And you add to that the overtime regulations that takes us from businesses that now have to pay overtime not after 23,000 but after 47,000 plus they have to meet that test of exemption, which is either administrative, professional, or executive. You have to meet the duties test. Those three issues, when you think about it, all possibly coming to bear at the end of the year present for us some extremely difficult issues to deal with. Each of them have a problem. Collectively, they could be very serious for a number of our businesses.
And back to the original question, what is the change? You know, because you mentioned things like there could be problems, it could be this, but ultimately, the chamber is against the minimum wage referendum questions that represent increases, right?
Let me correct that. If I left you with the impression there could be problems, I want to correct that and leave you the impression there will be problems. And we are opposed not to an increase in minimum wage, but to the plan before the public on November the 8th.
But let me ask you a question. Relative to minimum wage, who is looking out for the workers? So clearly the chamber represents businesses. So your mandate, you have a constituency, you have business owners, small business. So there's a group of people that have their interest that you work with. Relative to the men and women who are going to work and they're now earning $7 or $8 an hour, and then social services and government services many times have to pick up the tab, which ultimately becomes a kind of a tax, a deferred tax. How do we get to the point where this is even a referendum question? And I say that to open up the discussion because I do believe the minimum wage needs to be increased. I do believe people need a livable wage because I think it has to do with both economic issues and human dignity issues. But if not for government taking a position, there's not a natural mechanism for individuals to have a coalition to say, we need to raise the minimum wage. So who's on the other side of the argument from the chamber and from business owners? You know, I personally, for my business, I recognize 10-10 is the minimum wage because that's a federal guideline. And so it's not arbitrary. So for federal contracts, that's something that's been decided. The government doesn't want to work with businesses that pay less than that.
We supported that.
And I think that's a positive thing. But it feels like there's not, I don't want to say not enough of a voice, but an organized voice on the other side of the argument because it's so fragmented by workers.
Now you're doing to me exactly what I did to you in terms of, you didn't ask a question.
You do it better.
No.
We've got Dana Connors here. For 50 years, you've only had three jobs. And the reason why I think you've only had three jobs, and you've done them successfully, from city manager of Presque Isle to commissioner of transportation under two governors, and now for 22 years of the Chamber of Commerce, you do a great job advocating and taking positions while at the same time not potentially offending anyone on the other side of the argument. I don't have that skill because it feels like, you know, every other Tuesday, either writing a column or doing the radio thing, I'm offending somebody. I've had like 30 jobs in 50 years. So I say this with admiration, but there's so much politics connected to minimum wage. There would be impact on business because it's math, you know.
Yeah.
So for every, when you change the mathematical equation, what people are paying for their operating expenses, it'll impact businesses. But what's happened over the last two or three decades, whether it's through federal or state policy, I think is kind of egregious, where nobody has spoken up for workers. And you have people making $7 an hour. We shouldn't have even gotten to this position. And so the reason why it may feel like it's jumping too high now is more of a response to the deficit that we're digging out of for 30 years, wanting to maybe reset the economy a little bit.
Yep. I respect your point. Can I reverse ask him questions now? Because I think pretty strong question.
Deb just gave you permission.
No, I was just teasing. Let me address it in this way. If anyone thinks that the economy that we're in today is one that pits the employer against the employee, that's sad, that's wrong. And if I've contributed to that in any way, I apologize. Because the truth of the matter is, you're not going to get there unless the employer respects the employee and the employee listens to the employer. I mean, it is that fundamental. And the reason I think sometimes these impressions get created is because of the economy and the competitiveness and so forth. But I can tell you, in the business community today, if you don't pay attention to your employees by paying them marketable wages, by providing them benefits that are competitive, they're going to go somewhere else. That's how competitive it is. And when you think about that in terms of our workforce shortage that we have, skill has feet. I mean, they're going to move to the place that has them. The employer today is not saying, I don't want to increase minimum wage. They're saying it's a bit too much. I can't manage it. It puts us in an awkward place. We are living on the edge, and we've got to be sure that we survive. It's not in any way pitting one against the other. That's not the intention. Market has to have a place in this. And if you're going to raise a minimum wage,
but isn't the market above minimum wage? Isn't minimum by definition minimum? And the market decides the unlimited ceiling.
For the most part, here's a contention that is hard to argue with, is that on a minimum wage today, I truly believe the ones that will be hurt the most are the young people that come home from college that fill positions on a summer basis that that businesses need. They play a vital role. It helps the student. Maybe they even make a little more than the $750. But the truth of the matter is there's going to be a lot of that temporary help that's not going to be employed. Many of your fast foods today pay more than $750. And don't misunderstand what I said a moment ago. We're not arguing that $750 is the answer. We do believe it's an increase. And the $10 is what we put forward last year. If it's 10, yeah. 10, that's no big deal. But here's the other measurement that I think plays the best in our economy today. It should be a national minimum wage that's set for all states. If it's $10, then all states will live with it. If it's $12, all states will live with it. How many states? There's an effort out there to put in place a higher minimum wage, but it's done on an individual basis. We subscribe to that. The answer is, what is that amount? And should you get an increase every year? Well, if you do, that takes away one of our problems, which is a lack of predictability. There are many moving parts of that, but the thing that I want to be sure that I emphasize, this isn't about the employer disrespecting the employee. This is about recognizing that we're in this together. If you're going to be successful as a business, you've got to appreciate your employee. You do. I know you do.
I know.
And I think that is a good case to be made, is that it's about us, not about me.
I totally understand. We have Dana Connors here. He is the head of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. The only counter argument to that, and I understand as a referendum question, there's a lot of attention on this issue, is we got to this place because that view that you just conveyed has not been either prevalent or applied over the last 30 years. If it had, there would have been a closer trajectory of minimum wage between 30 years ago, which was kind of a pivot point relative to income, and now. And so I think it's great having the position in 2016 saying we need to be more thoughtful and it's not adversarial between employers and employees. But there's clear evidence over the last 30 years that employers have had more control, more legislative control, more governmental control. And there's a clear argument that minimum wages have been suppressed over 30 years to the point where they were always intended to be a livable threshold, a threshold that was supposed to be pegged to if a person worked full time and they made minimum wage, they could live. And at $7 an hour, which is the equivalent of about $14,000 a year, the mathematical formula on how a person, never mind a family or a couple of people, can live just doesn't exist. And what's happened is government programs for many people have had to pick up the slack, which goes back to the back door of taxpayers supporting it. So let me check this off.
Minimum
wage, the answer is the chamber says
you can't. You can't leave it there, because the only thing I will say to this, your thesis is not wrong, that you do have to adjust to the market conditions that prevail. Your use of 30 years is a little bit generous, because Maine has, over the years, tried to stay at a pace. We're better off than some of our adjoining states.
Right.
The truth is, we've always advocated that the federal government should set that level so that we all know what we're working with, so we don't compete with a New Hampshire or a Massachusetts or whatever the case may be. Your thesis of respecting the employee, I take no issue with. I applaud that. It's a matter of the math and the economy and making sure that the employee and the employer survive.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're working with the chamber. I agree. I don't know how, but I think we just agreed on something.
We did.
But you have three lobbyists that go to Augusta or to various municipalities advocating for business positions. There is no chamber of employees, and they certainly wouldn't have, I don't want to say high price lobbyists, but informed, active, day-to-day lobbyists. And so the counterbalance and the counter controls just have never existed. In the free market, if you applied that to other areas of either the economy or our Constitution, the free market is great in many areas, many economic areas, but it's not free when one side has either control or influence of mechanisms that the other does. It's kind of like self-professing that it's free. And saying to a person in a rural area of Maine, you have unlimited skill opportunity, they may or may not, whether it's through education, whether it's through their own aptitude. So if the government doesn't set a standard, that's where I think government does play a role. And you and I agree, I think it should be a federal minimum wage, because for the reasons you mentioned, you don't want to have disparity among states. And I think it represents the country's values, that here's where, given some places, maybe California, maybe San Francisco, they've looked at isolated additional minimum wages because the cost of living in some places is so disparate than the rest.
Yeah.
But I think we've agreed with something there. We only have a couple minutes left.
Dana, that in there so you have his last word.
Oh, no. When I'm on the Dana Connor show, I'm kidding. I always like these discussions with you because, all kidding aside, you've been invested in Maine, serving Maine as a town manager, as a commissioner of transportation, and now as a leader of the chamber for the state. And I think it's admirable. I think that, the public service, you've served governors, you are connected to not only in the state oversight, but I know that you have input in connection with our delegation that works in Congress. And I think that's important. But where you and I may or may not agree, I think
can't give up on that.
I know. We're moving away from minimum wage, and what I want to talk about is, and I've been jumping up and down for 8 years on this issue, to the point where I don't think anyone's listening to my jumping up and down, because maybe I just very quiet about it. But I've traveled to all 50 states. I've been to 30-something countries. I do business in virtually every state. In the last year, I've been from China to Amsterdam to UK to all over. Maine is the best place in the world. I love Maine. My wife and I have raised our kids here. I've created a number of businesses here. I've been lucky to work with some of the most talented people. We have a wonderful state, but we have such a parochial, provincial mindset when it comes to business, in my opinion, that we're creating the hurdles. And we have so much energy talking about business development directors from here to Canada, and once a week or twice a month. We've got a great state, but we've got some fundamental infrastructure issues, in that the new economy is about efficiency. It's about density. And when you mentioned a few minutes ago that throughout the state there are 25 or 30 active chambers representing about 5,000 businesses, I would argue that any place that has an active chamber probably has an active cluster of businesses or some economic viability. There are some places in the state where, whether their history was textiles or timber, the economy isn't coming back. So we have politicians getting together, telling constituents, hey, elect me, I'm going to bring Microsoft to Milo, Maine. Microsoft isn't coming, and I don't want to pick on Milo, but there are places in Maine where the economy isn't coming back. We need density and efficiency. And because capital, like electricity or water, seeks a natural path. I don't know if you remember, but years ago I was involved in politics. This goes back what
a long time.
During the Eisenhower administration, sure. I was part of the fake kitchen cabinet. But without picking on any politician, our good friend Paula Page, or Deb's good friend Paula Page,
yes,
went on a rant with a state legislator where he swore and he was vulgar and he wanted to challenge him to a duel and shoot him between the eyes. And I would argue that craziness, and as it becomes a national issue, has such a deeper impact on business here, more so than a sign on the highway that says open for business, more so than, you know, the fireworks industry that we passed a few years ago, which was ridiculous, more so than even our slots policy or our lottery ticket policy, which I think is despicable in terms of the human cost. We need real solutions relative to the tax burdens. And until we focus on developing economic zones where we have education, healthcare, and job density, we're pushing a rock up a hill. And so if I was part of the kitchen cabinet of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, you know, and I know that you serve your membership, but I would say to some people, hey, there's three core metro areas in terms of Portland Metro, Bangor, Lewiston, Auburn, and then there's 10 next-tier major markets that may have tourism and may have business development and MDI, and then there's maybe 10 other areas. And those are areas where when we put infrastructure, we need to invest for the future. We can't, you know, in your background as Commissioner of Transportation, you're even more acutely aware. For every mile, literally and figuratively, we put between new economy opportunity and people and services or healthcare or education or jobs, we put in inefficiency. In the new economy, with computers and iPhones, it's about nanosecond efficiency. And Maine is living 100 years ago where it's like, nah, we're going to do it this way. We're building this and jobs will come. They're not coming. If we don't have tighter clusters of educated people close to healthcare, close to education, last week we had on Javier Botana, the new superintendent of schools in Portland. Great conversation talking about vocational training because it's not all about college. But until we face the reality that Maine is too big to operate under the past infrastructure, because with 1.3 million people spread out over 35,000 square miles, the cost for public safety, for roads, for water treatment, for DEP, EPA is so great that the burden goes on to businesses. And we're not pulling people out of poverty. We're trapping them. And you have 30 seconds to respond, Dan, because there's only one small issue there.
I have to come back. I have to come back. I mean, you went on and expressed that.
I know. I was venting. Deb, you're supposed to hit the mic button whenever I vent like that. You're not supposed to.
It was too good.
I want to just say the solutions are there, but they're hard. They're hard solutions. We can't be telling people in some of these rural areas the economy's coming back.
It's not. Let me speak to that. How many seconds? 15 seconds?
No, I'm kidding. You have as much time as you need.
I'm not going to argue with the fact that there are issues out there and that undeniably there are some that are living in the past. But I don't agree that that's the essence of what you're finding for us and others. First of all, let's come to grips with the fact, and you touched upon it, is that the economy today isn't what it was yesterday. It's knowledge-based, it's technology, it's information, it's productivity, it's innovation, it's R&D, it's played on national stage, it's specialty in products, it's niche markets, where education skill plays a dominant role.
Right.
What does that mean for our economy? Well, it means quite different than where we had a paper industry or manufacturing base. But the thing is, we get caught so much in our own minds in the negative, we fail to see the positive. We know today that distance matters less, community matters more. People want to be identified with a quality of life. We have a quality of life. We have a quality of our people. Work ethic is second to none. Right. And we have a quality of place. Everybody loves to come here. The thing that I get more often is, Dana, I would love to come to your state. Can you find me a job? Is there a job that I can move? And when you look at where some of the experiences we're having this summer, and part of it's tourism, but for every person who comes here and visits, they're going to take away a very good feeling. I can guarantee you that. I think that we're on the brink of changing that attitude to focus on the things that really matter. I mean, when you look, again, I go back to this point because I want to build upon it, is that Mainers by their very nature don't focus on the positive. so much of our economy is built around consumer confidence. What's consumer confidence? It's attitude. What's attitude? It's feeling good about where we're going. When we talk about our problems all the time, and I admit, I'm not saying we deny our problems. I'm saying we prioritize and work together to face them. But you cannot deny the power of positive. You cannot. I mean, when we look at manufacturing today, we have an advanced manufacturing environment in the state that's very strong, that's precision. Look at Pratt Whitney. Look at Bath Iron Works. Look at a number of businesses that we have, from Volk Packaging to Rogue Pro.
Biotech and MDI, there's some great Jackson Labs.
Absolutely.
There's some advanced businesses, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you look around, we are on the brink of some very good things. Our biggest challenge is that we need to inventory all of that, and we need to promote the living daylights out of it, because that will give people hope, and it'll get people away from thinking, oh, we're still hanging on to the past. I don't deny that there are parts of our past that we need to carry forward, and a lot of them aren't going to be the same. And that's because, and more than anything else, market conditions, you know, the competitive nature, the lack of productivity, the lack of innovation. 80% of a growth economy comes from innovation, new ways of doing things, new products being developed. I contend that there is a very positive future for Maine. And I think that the key to all of that is what you touched upon when you spoke to the superintendent, that education today is the foundation of that future success. But it's not promoting every one of us to get a PhD in something. It's recognizing that the skills that are relevant and important through credentials, certifications, the welding, the plumbing, all of those things are so fundamentally important today. And I think we've come to grips with that. We have been in a place where, in the past, where if you ask the educator, this is a national figure, not Maine, but I think it's relevant, that 72% of the educational community say, well, yeah, we're preparing our people for the economy. If you ask the business person, they'd say, well, it's 42% would be more likely. So that mismatch, if you will, is to me a more reflection of a transition from an economy that we used to have, that one that's developed into a service industry, a tourism type of presence, and now we're recognizing that entrepreneurial, small business, innovation, R&D, all of those things, and the importance of broadband access puts us in a place where distance doesn't matter. But to my point, community does.
Now, again, we found another point of common agreement. I agree, community and human connectivity is kind of core to the human experience, whether it has to do with the economy or the state of Maine. People gather in tribes. People want to share the experience of hurling through space and not being isolated. So I agree with that. I counter a little bit of the broadband argument as a bit of mythology that for the last 10 years has been promoted in terms of economic development, which is now that we have broadband and we have fiber optics and we have connectivity rural, that jobs will pop up and Intel and Microsoft and higher tech or programming jobs. That happens a little bit. But you still have to be somewhere, and at 5 or 6 o'clock at the end of the day, you still have to be somewhere that you want to be, and in the morning, you still have to send your kids to school somewhere that you feel like they're getting a grade A education, and if somebody falls and breaks their leg, you need to be somewhere where you think you can get the best health care possible. We can't do that over 30,000 square miles. It's a physics thing. So people talk about the philosophy, the ideology of Maine's economy. It's physics. We could pit the other four states in Maine. You know, Maine is built with an infrastructure that can accommodate 8 million people. We don't have that. We have 1.3. And so there'll always be these structural hurdles that have to be compensated for through a taxation policy, which continues the cycle.
Where did you ever get the figure that we could accommodate 8 million people by our infrastructure? Having been in transportation, it would be very difficult to accommodate. My point about broadband is simply that think of it as your highway or transportation system. Your transportation system or your broadband is not the end of itself.
Right.
It's the means to the end. It's how businesses conduct business on a global basis to provide that connectivity. You are right. At the end of the day, that community that is part of your quality of life, which is so special to Mainers.
Right.
We have it in abundance. We just don't talk about it like we should.
And it's special to Mainers. And, yep. But we also have to have it special to people outside of Maine if we want them to come. And I don't know if we're going to solve it here today. What do you think? I mean, we're out of time. I mean, I thought we were on the path when we went – when we were talking about minimum wage for 40 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
I thought we were. I thought, yeah. I know, but the
you,
little
you
discussions
so
about
many
slot machines,
that,
I know.
I mean, if I took issue with everything you said in that last dissertation, we'd be here for another half hour. I will say this, that you're right. Attitude matters, what you say, how you market it, be as positive as you can. I mean, we stand here today promoting more new Mainers all the time.
I agree.
Welcoming the immigrant community. So, we agree.
But not everyone's welcoming it. They're Shifty and Larry and something else, and our governor does things, which isn't a small thing.
It's not a small thing.
The biggest megaphone in the state is our chief executive.
Absolutely.
And so all the other comments and meetings and everyone's cheering, and my good friend Alan Karen writes positive books every year, and he has meetings every month and pulling people together. All that's great. But if the perceived reality from outside the state is, man, you guys have too high of a tax burden, you've got kind of a crazy leader, you've got this inefficiency thing, that's the key. So we can, you know, and I don't want to compare it to the guys playing, you know, music in the Titanic that is like, come on, boys, let's stay positive. But if our economy has a hole in it and it's sinking, it's great to celebrate the guys playing the violin in the Titanic, but I'd rather focus on the engineers trying to fix the hole, try to get a Mayday out and jump onto an iceberg, because those are things that will have a meaningful change. The violins are nice. I love violin, but I don't think that element solves the problem.
It's part of the solution.
It creates a nice mood. I agree. I think it's part of it. I don't mean to be lighthearted about
that.
You
are a little hardcore here today.
I know, because you know what? After 8 years of talking about the economy and trying to, and I admire, again, we have Dan O'Connor here, who I hope will come back, because he's one of my favorite. He's one of my favorite people in the whole state.
Steve, with all the things you said, I have to come back.
You'll have a checklist of things to.
I'm writing them down.
I know, but you're president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, so that's a significant position, and you represent businesses throughout the state, so that's an important thing.
I will say this. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed the discussion. My final word would be this. As important as it is to not deny our problems and to work together to resolve them, it's equally good, using the words of author, I think it was Alex Haley, who wrote the book Roots, is to find the good and praise it.
I agree. Let's end on that note. Thank you so much for being here, Dana.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it. Yeah. We've had Dana Connors here. He's the president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. Their website is mainchamber.org. He is accessible if you're involved in business or in your community. Send him an email. Invite him to come talk to you. He's one of the best, the brightest, and the most committed people here in Maine. You've been listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O, WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM. We'll be back next week.